Well, we're looking at the accounts of Moses. And I think I'll read verses 23 and 24 in chapter 2 of Exodus. Otherwise, if I read more, it'd be too long. And it came to pass in process of time that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage. And they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. I was just looking now what you're singing at where I could have read. I was looking for the accounts of Abraham, but we leave it like that. Now then, we're looking at the character of Moses and God's dealing with him and made him what he wanted him to be. Now then, it is rather interesting about Moses that we need to notice. In Numbers 12, verse 3, now the man Moses was very meek above all the men which were upon the face of the earth. Not weak now, but controlled strength. And we call it humility. But humility is not natural to men and women. It is a God-given thing, but we'll come to that in a moment. By all accounts, by the way, this is a quotation by Alexander White. By all accounts, Moses did not begin by being a meek man. The truth is, no truly meek man ever does so begin. It is not true meekness if it is found in any man at the beginning of his life. It's either softness or easiness or easygoingness or indifference, but not meekness. True meekness must be planted and watered and established and purified and beaten upon by every wind of God, and and cut to pieces by every knife of God. It will be nearer to say that Moses began, which was a hasty man, a hot-tempered man, far, far from being a meek man. And you only have to look at his history, his behavior. He was pretty wild, angry, quick-tempered, and quite vicious. And that's the man God chose. Now, he has to deal with this man so that we're able to say about him, he was the meekest man that ever walked on the earth. So he was not born a naturally meek young person. He was indeed quite a violent man and aggressive. Now then, when he was first 40 years of his life, he was somebody. He was a prince. The second 40 years, he's a nobody. That's where he learns. He's a nobody. And the third 40 years, God uses nobodies. Do you follow that? First 40 years, he's quite somebody. Chariots, wealth, all the lot. Second, a nobody. Third, God uses nobodies. Now, that may sound strange, but really it does make spiritual sense. Now, the covenant. years of favor enjoyed. They had enjoyed benefits, had the Jews, because of Joseph. And Joseph went to Egypt and his brothers eventually joined him. and the people of Israel, the Jews, they enjoyed favor because of Joseph. But things changed. A king died, another came, and who'd forgotten all about Joseph. And so we have generations of terrible cruelty and of slavery in Egypt, I think about 400 years. So long, long forgotten is Joseph, his wisdom, and his help to Pharaoh. There is a new law there now. And indeed, a very harsh one too. They could see that these slaves were multiplying. And they were afraid if there are too many of them, they might overcome us numerically. And so they made a decree to kill all the male babies. Throughout the whole then of the Jewish community, there was great sorrow as these little children, little boys, were killed. And in the verse 23, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. Now then, we begin there really. At last, they begin to sigh. They hadn't sighed before. They grumbled maybe. But they are sighing now. And the Church of Jesus Christ has to come to that place where it sighs. Say, we look at the situation today and the terrible confusion evangelically and in all the Reformed constituency as well. And we are beginning to sigh. Where is this going to lead us? Where are these false teachings going to end? I think we have a book, and the book that we'll have, called The New Calvinism. And it's very, very frightening. It's no relationship at all to the real Calvinism. I believe in those, I describe it myself like this, the right thing, the three R's. The old school teachers would use this, not very good spelling, but still the idea was good. Reading, writing, arithmetic. Now, I had to speak once in the after meeting in Heath, and I couldn't think of what. I'd forgotten. I said, what can I say? What can I say? And I thought of the three R's. The Reformed faith, a radical change of life, and reverence in worship. Now then, if you take one of them out, they all fall. You take away reverence in worship, then your Reformed faith is meaningless. You have no respect for that God. Or if there's no radical change in your life, it is useless. The doctrines have had no effect upon you. You have to have all three. It's not only the doctrines of grace, as we call them, but the grace of the doctrines as well. They sighed because they could see great danger to the faith. Now, the children in captivity, they were in bondage. It's about time we learned their lesson to sigh. We can say in Wales anyway that the last century, not entirely without blessing, and the effects of the 1904 revival went on really into the 70s and 80s with many people. But as a nation, generally, there had been a spiritual landslide. It happened rapidly after the 80s. And I think now we're beginning to realize, and at least in some places, not many, there is a sigh. Will we survive? I know we can have verses that say, about the Church of God, that it will always be kept by God, that nothing shall destroy her. That is true. But it may not be here. It was destroyed in the places of the ancient countries, but it rose somewhere else. It will never, the gates of hell shall not prevail against her, but you can have it declining completely in one area, you can have that, and that has happened many, many times in Israel, and you have then a spiritual wilderness. Now then, and God heard this their groaning, verse 24, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. He remembered that. Now, this is what I was looking for. I have it quite neatly here. In chapter 17 of Genesis, you could say it begins there. And verses 1 to 8. Sorry, here we are. Chapter 17. And when Abram was 90 years old and nine, the Lord appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am the Almighty God. Walk before me and be thou perfect. Now he's speaking to a pagan man, the heir of the Chaldees. And you might say, well, how on earth does this happen? And I will make my covenant between me and thee, and will multiply thee exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. Notice the Jews later got it wrong. They thought it was themselves, the father of many nations. Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be called Abraham, for a father of many nations have I made thee, and I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee, and I will establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed after thee in their generations for an everlasting covenant to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. Now, that's the background. That's where they come from this man called of God. From a pagan, hopeless situation, he makes a covenant with him. What has happened to these poor people? They have been in captivity for so long, and they sigh for God, and he heard their sigh. The people of God come, they wanted eventually, and they do come to Canaan, and they come to their inheritance. In the covenant of grace, it's us, his people, this Israel of God and heaven, these things are sure, and they are for us as well. On times, we lose sight, and it causes us to sigh. He draws near, the God of grace. We have lost, as a country, we have lost sight. We have forgotten what the old people said. We have forgotten how they prayed. And they did pray in a very special way. They really brought heaven down. They reached the throne. You know, they just clung to the person of God, his majesty. They did make petitions, but they were very brief at the end and not really direct. It was the glory of God. That is what they were concerned about. But they are forgotten. Aren't they? They are forgotten. But we are hoping and trusting that God will hear the sigh of some of us, that he will hear that sigh. Now, there are times that we lose sight, I know, but there are times when he causes us to cry out to him. Now, the care, the mysterious ways of God. In Exodus 2, 1, 2, 3, and 4, that's right. And there went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi, and the woman conceived and bare a son. And when she saw that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could not longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch and put the child therein. And she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. And his sister And his sister stood afar to it that would be done to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along by the riverside. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him, and said, "This is one of the Hebrew children." Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." And the maid went and called the child's mother. Now that's the beginning, really, of the story of Moses, where he enters into the scene. But he enters into great wealth and a high position. And the child, says verse 10, and the child grew. And she brought him into Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she called his name Moses. So he was of the Hebrews, he was of the Jews. When they thought that they'd managed to kill all the male children to decimate their numbers in case they might uprise sometime, yet one special one is saved. It's amazing. Out of all those, only one, but the hand of God was there. He's still a Hebrew in verses 11 and 12. And it came to pass in those days, when Moses had grown, that he went out into his brethren and looked on his burdens, and he spied an Egyptian smiting in Hebrew, and one of his brethren, and he looked his way and that way. And when he saw that there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Why did he do that? He knew he was a Hebrew, and he had a great feeling for his people. And so he murders this man. This is exactly what he does. There's something violent in his character, and angry. He's angry through the suffering of his people. And in verse 14, he has a fright, because he thought he was not known or not seen. And he said, one of the Hebrews said, "And who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killest the Egyptian?" And Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." So he was very frightened now, because he knew that Pharaoh would have no mercy. And he is very anxious about that. Pharaoh's anger would no mercy at all. So he becomes a shepherd. Jethro. He never had a flock of his own. And for 40 years, he marries. He's in Gershom. And he says, "I have been a stranger in a strange land." And yet the covenant of promise remained. It's amazing sometimes how fragile it seems the covenant is. I've often given a little illustration about the church of our Lord Jesus Christ. In a time of revival, it's like a thick cord. Then at times of misery, backsliding and carelessness, and it's slender, like a little, just a little bit of silk. But it's God's cord, and it won't break. You might say, "Well, it's slender. Is it not in danger?" No. It's God's cord. It's lovely when it's nice and thick like a rope. That's true. But even as it is today, it's slender, just like a little silk line, really. Yet it cannot be destroyed, because it is God's. The covenant of promise remains. He was a prince, now a pauper, but he was content. Now think, I want you to think about this man. He was now content. This wild man, this man who murdered, you might say he had an excuse for it, but murder is inexcusable anyway. He was hot-tempered. He had a hungry spirit in him. And you might say, how will God deal with him? And God says quietly, 40 years looking after somebody else's sheep will do him a lot of good. It's a long time. A long time. God's dealings brings him to a place where he will listen to God. What was God doing? Bringing him that to position when at last he says, I know now that Moses will listen to me. I could never have got this man to listen to me unless I got him to this place that he might be the meekest man in the whole earth. What, Moses meek? This violent prince? This proud prince? This murderer? This quick-tempered man? Yes, this man. I will make of him the meekest man on earth. So he will begin to listen to me. It'd be useless to talk to him before then, but now I can talk to him. Now the call. God left him to be a shepherd for a long time. Not even his own flock. In chapter 3, verse 1, now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. Moses was nothing. Yet he does not murmur. Do you murmur? Have a little grouse about somebody or something or your lot? Why do I have to go to that? Why should I listen to them? Why should I take any notice? Words flow apace when we complain and fill our fellow creatures' ears with a sad tale of our complaints. A murmurer. Are we murmurers? He was not. He didn't say, I know I was a wild young man, but I have patiently loved Jethro and his family and settled with them. They're not my sheep, but I've cared for them and I've loved them. So he was being changed, almost unknown to him. He was nothing. He never murmured or had regrets. I wish I hadn't killed that Egyptian. I had a lovely life. I had 20, 30, 40 chariots, as well. I don't know how many horses and servants. I had this. He never, never said, look what I've given up. People do, but he did not. He had no regrets at all. It is a testing time. His humble lot, the agony of his people goes on. Now, you might say, why doesn't God hurry up? God's timing is perfect timing. Sometimes you feel, well, why doesn't he help us now? Why doesn't he hurry up? He's got it all in hand. He really has. We must learn to trust him and believe in him. At Horeb, God called him, and there is a remarkable event in the life of Moses. It is the active sovereignty of God. It looks as if God had almost forgotten his people and forgotten his covenant with Abraham, yet he had not. In verse 2, we have these words. In chapter 3, and the angel of the Lord. Now, when we have the angel of the Lord, normally it refers to Jesus Christ. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire, and out of the midst of the bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. Strange event. It puzzles him. And Moses said, I will now turn aside. I'll turn away, look again. Pastor, I'm not well or something. I'll have another look and see this great sight and why the bush is not burnt. He's amazed at this great encounter, but it is an intervention of the kind he'd never known the like before. In verse 3, and when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, look how simple it is. All he said was, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here am I, here am I. God calls in his exact time, in a precise time, more accurate than anything we can imagine. And the simple reply, not complicated, not saying, here I am, I've trained me, I'm now a humble man. No, nothing like that. That thought doesn't come to him. He doesn't grumble either. Why did you put me in this awful desert for 40 years? Nothing like that. Here I am. Here am I. The call is personal. The call is holy. Something that we overlook in the nature of God. This beautiful, pure simplicity. And God said, and draw not, verse 5, and he said, draw not nigh hither, put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place wherein thou standest is holy ground. This is rather special, Moses. Take your shoes off. This is holy ground. Have we forgotten the holiness of God? Have we forgotten when we are praying that we are approaching the great Creator? You know, do we really, are we aware of that? And he reminds us of other events too. The holy place when God draws near, God speaks. Moreover, he said, I am the God, he speaks to now, and it's rather interesting. I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham. So it goes right to the beginning of it. The God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. And Moses put his face, for he was afraid. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Now you can understand that. God is dealing with him, and he is overawed at it all. Yet he had come into the presence of God. Now, what about us in a service? Without thy presence, King of Saints, how did the revival people return from a meeting in the early hours of the morning praising God? I don't mean this in kindness, it's true of me and everybody. How do we? We talk quite nice little things, harmless things, but nothing, nothing, empty. But they would go home praising God. Without thy presence, King of Saints. Now, do we want that? You have to decide your heart. Do I want it? Our purpose fails. Our spirit faints. Thou must our wavering faith renew ere we can yield the service true. Do something to us, God, that we might be like that. Verse 7. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction. Now he goes into detail with Moses. I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. He knows. He knows that this sigh is not a grumble. It's an anguish. It's a cry of anguish. Oh God, what shall we do? Oh God, where shall we turn? It's a cry from the heart. So he prepares a man called Moses. All this in the desert, talking to a nobody. His name was Moses. Talking to a nobody. Moses. Moses. Here am I. The call is absolute. The call has a purpose in view. Now, will we sigh for him? When we have exhausted our store of endurance, when our strength has failed ere the day is half done, when we reach the end of our hoarded resources, then we'll see it. Our Father's forgiving is only begun. He's saying, really, I know thy sorrows. So shall his presence bless our souls and shed a joyful light. That hallowed morn shall chase away the sorrows of the night. Think now. Think that we'll be able to say, look what God has done. His presence in our souls has shed a joyful light. That hallowed morn he came has chased away. What's he chased away? The sorrows of the night, the indifference, the carelessness, the sin, the murmuring, the grumbling, all those things, he's chased them away. And there's no room for them. There's only room now for God. So Moses now has 40 years of usefulness. 40 years a prince. 40 years a nobody, but learning the lesson of humility. And 40 years serving God. What a long theological training he had. Many can say, I've been 5 years in theological and so on, but he can say, no, I walked with him for 40 years. Did you murmur, Moses? Oh no, why should I? Did you not regret the riches you left? No, I esteemed the riches of the children of God, better riches, and those of Israel, of the Egyptians, the sorrow, and that hallowed morn shall chase away, I love it, the sorrows of the night. And perhaps we will look back and say, see how he chased them away. See what he did with us. And see what he did in our being. And see what he did with our personality. That God will call you, whatever your name is, John, William, Mary, Thomas, Moses. Are you able to answer? Here am I. I trust that will be true of us as we begin this amazing account of Moses.